Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. Two decades after the Iranian Revolution, the West remains both fascinated with Iran and puzzled by it. For the policymaker, Iran is a country of menace and mystery, set against a confusing background of reform and repression. But for the scholar, Iran is best understood in the context of her 3,000-year history, a record of grand achievement in the arts and sciences, reflected today in countless shrines to poets and saints. Now, the weight of history and the reverence of Iranians for their shrines suggests that an ancient culture, rather than modern politics, may be the best guide to the future of Iran. My guest today is Afshin Molavi, author of Persian Pilgrimages. Welcome to Dialogue, Afshin.
Thank you, George, for having me.
It's good to have you here.
And thank you.
Let me hold up this very attractive book of yours, Persian Pilgrimages.
Thank you.
And as a matter of fact, my first question is going to be about how you did this book, the architecture of it.
Sure.
In my shorthand, it's a sort of horizontal journey across Iran, and a kind of a vertical journey back and forth through time. Is that right? And if so, why did you do it that way?
That's right. I think you're exactly right. And I did it that way because I wanted to present essentially three things throughout this book. First, I thought it was very important to present the voices of the Iranian people.
Right.
And across 20 cities and villages, I engaged with Iranians from a wide cross-section of socioeconomic backgrounds. I simply said to them, tell me your story, and they did. And the stories were enlightening, they were sad, they were inspiring, they were in times tragic. And and what was most interesting is how eager Iranians were to talk.
I must say, that struck me, that it seemed everyone was extremely forthcoming to you. Now, of course, you were born in Iran, you're an American,
that's
right. Were born there, and so that must have helped somewhat in
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I went unfiltered by the voice of an interpreter, and I spoke directly with Iranians. But on the other hand, they, you know, when I did tell them I was a journalist, when I did tell them I have come from America, they were even more interested in engaging with me. And they really wanted to, it seemed as if at times I had turned on a faucet and Niagara Falls came rushing out.
That, again, I think is very well put. As a reader, I found an enthusiasm for contact with America and things American, which makes any reader, I think, lament all the more that there's so little dialogue
between
the peoples.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so the first thread of the narrative, if you will, was these voices of the Iranian people. The second thread of the narrative was Iranian history. As you said in your intro, Iran has a very rich history, about 3,000 years of recorded history, starting with, I started my own journey with the rise of the Persian Empire and the tomb of Cyrus the Great. It's set in this dramatic windswept plain 80 miles outside of the city of Shiraz. And I worked my way through Iranian history, and I went to shrines that I thought had an importance in Iranian history, but also had some relevance to today's contemporary Iranian predicament.
And I think your choices were very well made. As a matter of fact, the importance of heroes, saints and poets in particular, to Iranians is very much reinforced throughout the book. And I want to turn to that first pilgrimage you made, to the tomb of Cyrus the Great, who is an icon and a touchstone still in Iran today, I think, lauded for a tolerance that he may or may not have reflected in real life. But one of the things I was struck by, Afshin, in that particular early portion of the book was people go, and they go in families, they go in hordes, large numbers of people go to the shrines. They go to the shrine of Cyrus the Great. He, of course, represents an age of Persian might, conquest, and power. And yet these are modern people going there in a time of economic plight and difficulty. I wonder how that contrast affects them.
That's right, that's right. It was a very interesting story about this. When I was visiting the shrine, I was visiting the shrine with a 25-year-old young man. And this young man is a child of the Islamic Republic. He was born 2 years before the revolution in 1979. And his schooling was in the schools of the Islamic Republic. Now, the schools of the Islamic Republic ignored pre-Islamic history. They favored post-Islamic history, and Iran, interestingly, is neatly divided into two 1,300-year slices.
1,300-year periods, exactly.
That's right, of pre-Islamic and post-Islamic. Mm-hmm. And when I visited the shrine with this young man, he was very keenly interested in the Cyrus tomb. He was very interested in the history of Cyrus the Great. He said to me, you know, I wish in my schools I learned more about Cyrus the Great. However, he was deeply grounded in today's reality, because at one point there was a tour guide at the shrine who said to him, oh, this is awful. This shrine is not being kept up well. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, Coke bottles on the ground. There was cucumber skins on the ground. And this 25-year-old man said, look, Cyrus the Great had a wonderful life. What about us young people? We don't have jobs. We need a better future.
That was extremely resonant. Also, the fact that he was 25.
That's right.
Because the book brings this out very powerfully through the numbers of young people you interview. Iran is a country of young people.
That's right.
And Afshin, let me ask you to put your prophetic cap on right now. Right. The fact that the people are so young, the fact that, and they seem to be very pragmatic and very practical about their needs. Now, what does that imply for tomorrow?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right when you say they are very pragmatic. What struck me the most about the young Iranians that I met is that their dreams were neither exotic nor overly ambitious. Many of them simply wanted the dignity of a job, the dignity of economic self-sufficiency. The unemployment rate is very high, and this affects young people very much. It's 16%, but independent economists put it closer to 25%. Wow. There's massive underemployment. You have numerous college graduates I met who are driving taxis. You have physicians who are working as traders, engineers going into business, because salaried professionals, it's very difficult for them to live in Iran right now. So among these young people, they're really just looking for the very basics, the kind of things that we sometimes forget and we take for granted living in the West, is the potential for a career, potential for healthcare. And when they would ask me questions, yes, they were interested in things like Leonardo DiCaprio and the movie Titanic, and yes, they were interested in the Backstreet Boys and all these things, but they would also ask me about healthcare programs and university programs, and so many of them would line up outside these embassies looking to get visas to go abroad.
As a matter of fact, some of the pilgrimages toward the end of the book are what I call green card privilege pilgrimages.
That's right, that's right.
You know, speaking of youth and what they are looking forward to, what they really need, I was also struck, and I guess this really affected most of the middle-class youth in Tehran, with the kinds of social maneuvering they have to do these days. I mean, you were, for example, a witness to some parties and that kind
That's
of
right.
thing, where they feel cramped, if not persecuted, by the so-called morals police and other
That's right. I describe in the book a North Tehran youth party. Mm-hmm. And these are a North Tehran youth party. North Tehran is one of the more affluent areas of Iran. And these youth parties are the Islamic Republic's worst nightmare. You have hip-shaking youth, you have alcohol, and the latest music from Paris, the latest music from the United States. And at this particular party that I describe, which was a quite a common scene, they had the knock on the door from the morals police.
Right. And the women go upstairs.
The women go upstairs, absolutely, and they put on their headscarves. Mm-hmm. And the two young men who were hosting the party, they went to the door, they lied to the police and said, oh, no, we're not having a party. It's just a cousin of ours is in town from Germany. Right. Handed him a few bills as a bribe, and he walked away.
But you know what will impress the American reader, I think you might agree with me, was the innocence and the modesty of that party group.
Absolutely.
They were just having a good time. I mean, there was really nothing untoward.
That's right. And you're absolutely right about that. Someone even described it as sort of a Mentos commercial one time. You know, these kids just dancing and smiling at each other and harmless flirting that's taking place.
Right.
And I think it's important to remember that it's not just in the affluent areas of Iran that this sort of thing is taking place. Iranian youth across the country, I mean, I spoke with a wide variety of youth, and they simply want the right to be able to walk down the street with a girlfriend without being harassed and vice versa.
And those aspirations are absolutely poignant. Let me turn to something else that comes, I think, very early in the book, and to me was an absolute revelation. Many things were a revelation in this book. The 1979 revolution, I generalize here, but I think it's fair to say that for many of us in the West, we viewed it as, you know, the clergy takes over.
Right.
But you point out there were a lot of protagonists to that battle. The clergy did win out, but it's a much more complex undertaking.
This is
true. Then we may
Yes, that's right. For the revolutionary forces, you had Marxists, you had communists, you had Islamic Marxists, known as the Mojahideen-e-Khalq. You had these radical anti-imperialist guerrilla groups known as the Fedayeen-e-Khalq. You had nationalist Democrats. And you had many people who were simply longing for an undefined utopia at the other end of the monarchy. Mm-hmm. The view was, well, if the Shah were to go, maybe my economic situation would improve. Perhaps there would be more political freedom.
Right.
I did quote some people in the book who said that they went out into these demonstrations, not necessarily knowing what they were demonstrating for, mm-hmm. but they knew what they were demonstrating against.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, that complexity, does that still play out? I mean, those forces that you mentioned, mm-hmm. they may have been subdued when the clergy take over, mm-hmm. but they're still there, is that right?
To some extent they are, but now you see far less of the Marxists, far less of the communists, and now you see more of the nationalist Democrat types, mm-hmm. and you see more secular nationalists. In the system, the way it's structured right now, the secular nationalists don't have a voice because they would not be given a voice. They're not allowed to run for parliament. They're not allowed to run for president. It's still an insiders-only struggle.
Right.
And even the reformists, that some of the political rhetoric that they're using could undermine the Islamic Republic as we know it, but they're not calling for an undermining of the Islamic Republic. They're calling for a reform of the Islamic Republic.
Adding to the complexity, another insight I gained from the book, mm-hmm. is the fact that clergy's not monolithic either.
That's right.
And here's something else about the clergy I want to quickly mm-hmm. toss in, because I was so proud of myself for learning this, that if you look back through Iranian history, I mean, well over time, over the thousands of years, there's, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, mm-hmm. but it seemed to me a kind of duality, clergy and court, mm-hmm. that's always been a kind of Iranian tension, if you will, between these two forces. So
That's right. In the if we go back to the 16th century, and one of the shrines I visited was the shrine of Mullah Muhammad Baqir Majlisi. He's a late 17th century cleric, but we have to go back to the 16th century with the rise of a dynasty known as the Safavids.
Right.
And this dynasty was the first to implant Shiism mm-hmm. on Iranian soil. Mm-hmm. Before the Safavids, Iranians were primarily Sunni. In fact, there was a scene in which one of the Safavid leaders had entered the city of Tabriz in northwest Iran, and he came proclaiming this new Shia faith, and he searched all of the libraries of Tabriz, and they found one book about Shiism in all the libraries of Tabriz. And Shiism differs from Sunnism in that clerics do have a more prominent role in interpreting the Quran.
That's a very good point. And does that stronger role in interpreting mm-hmm. the Quran, is that an aspect or an example of a point I think you made here that bears on this, that mm-hmm. when Islam came to Iran through mm-hmm. Arab conquest, I think the phrase you used is it gained a bureaucracy.
That's right.
And is that because one example being the Shia clerics were more active in the interpreting and so forth?
Well, it gained the bureaucracy more so because they were conquering an old empire, the Persian Empire. And so the Persian Empire had bureaucrats who were accustomed to running a far-flung empire.
Right.
So in much the same way that when the Persians conquered Babylonia in the 6th century BC, they gained from the Babylonian bureaucrats and the Babylonian Empire. So that's how they had gained this bureaucracy, so to speak.
Because you point out there 1,300 years from Cyrus to the point of the Islamic conquest, and 1,300 years from that point to now.
That's right.
It's a marvelous symmetry there.
That's right.
But thinking also of that symmetry and the power of Islam mm-hmm. throughout the world, the power of the Iranian expression of Islam, I'm struck by this also. There was, and I think still is, a resistance to what might be called Arabization.
Mm-hmm.
Islam in Iran, I think, is, or at least... the religion was accepted, but not much of the other culture.
That's right. You've got it exactly right. And what happened was with the Arab invasion of Iran in the year 637 and the Arab defeat of the once mighty Persian Empire, you know, for elite Iranians of that era, the landed gentry in particular, it was a very disorienting defeat because here was this upstart invader coming in, and with them they brought this enticing new faith, which was enticing to the people of Iran at the time, because the faith that was prevalent in Iran at the time was Zoroastrianism, which is a noble faith, but it had reduced itself to rigid caste and ritual. And so the people in Iran felt that this Islamic egalitarian wind that blew across the country was welcome. However, the culture of the invaders was not welcome because Iran had this old culture themselves. So Iran managed to do what Egypt and Assyria and other old civilizations did not do. It resisted the Arabization of its culture while accepting the faith of Islam.
So culturally it remains very much Persian.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right.
And in remaining Persian, here is the theme we really have to introduce with great emphasis and great power, and that's the importance of poetry and literature.
Absolutely.
Some of the most moving pilgrimages you make are to the shrines of poets, Ferdowsi.
Right. That's right, Ferdowsi.
Ferdowsi.
Yeah, that's right.
Hafez,
right.
And others. Now, speak to us a bit about what that means. And these men, of course, I think for American and Western viewers, Omar Khayyam is going to resonate very powerfully. But all of these men were...
That's right. With Ferdowsi, he's interesting because Ferdowsi sang... Ferdowsi, first of all, was in the 9th and 10th century, and he was one of these Iranians who I spoke about, elite, landed, gentry Iranians who felt that the Arab invasion was quite disorienting because he was very proud of his culture, very proud of his Iranian-ness, and very proud of Iran's pre-Islamic history.
Right.
Whereas there were clerics at the time who were saying that pre-Islamic history was jahiliya, is the Arabic term, known as the age of ignorance.
Ah.
So Ferdowsi and many other scholars of that era began writing what are called shahnamehs, books of kings. Ferdowsi wrote the seminal Book of Kings. It took him 35 years to make, and he sang of Iran's pre-Islamic glories. And it was an extraordinary feat, particularly because he refused to use Arabic words. He used something like only about 100 Arabic words in the 60,000 lines of this epic, which is similar to Homer's Iliad or the Aeneid. Now, the other poets, Hafez, Sa'di, Omar Khayyam, that I talk about, I think they're very important because if you look at their poetry, it's a sensual poetry, you know, it's a poetry of tolerance, and it's also a poetry that takes sharp aim at religious hypocrisy.
Right.
And that resonates in today's Iran because there is a view among many that there are clergymen who tell Iranians that they must pray, they must follow the exoteric aspects of religion, while they themselves are hoarding silver and gold, as one of the poets says.
Well, I was struck by this. The presence of these poets is real, and intellectuals today will quote major sections of their poetry is just as a kind of personal commitment. I was also struck by the fact that a lot of the clerics write their own poetry and try to reinterpret at times the old masters in ways that are useful to them. And Ayatollah Khomeini himself wrote poetry. It can be interpreted various
that's
ways.
That's right. Ayatollah Khomeini has a book of poems called The Jug of Love. And in these poems, they are quite mystical. And he talks about the languid eyes of his lover. Now, in his case, his chroniclers tell us we are supposed to interpret that as the intoxication of
God.
A lover for God.
You know?
But this sort of conceit has always been used, and this ambiguity has always been at the heart of Persian poetry, because someone can take a Hafez poem from the 14th century and say he's talking about love of God, and the wine that he's talking about is the intoxication of being with God. Somebody else will say, no, he's talking about drinking wine, and the lover he's talking about is his physical lover.
Right. You know, when we speak of and I love poetry, I must say, I find this poetry, and even in translation, extremely powerful. Mm-hmm. But Afshin, when we're speaking of these themes, these poets, this power, we must be speaking of eternal verities. I mean, the way Iranians ideally see themselves. So I'm going to ask you what those qualities are. I mean, one that comes immediately, strikes you right in the face, is the love of beauty.
I think you nailed it, George. That's certainly one of them. And you know, even if you look back into the 6th century, 5th century BC, and the 4th century when the battles with the Greeks took place, you know, the Persians of that era viewed the Greeks as little more than, you know, what one chronicler said, naked savages with little appreciation for beauty and wine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that the poets have always managed to say things that the population have wanted to say themselves,
right.
But they were not in a position to do so. Poets have always been granted a certain license, mm-hmm. a certain space in Iranian society that the average person was not granted. That's why Hafez in the 14th century can come out and write a poem that is critical of the king.
Yeah.
And he can get away with it because he's using allegory. He's using the language that is accepted. And for many Iranians, not just in the 14th century, Hafez moving up to the 19th and 20th century, the poets were their voice.
Mm-hmm. Let me show you what a good Iranian I am.
That's right.
Come fill the cup, and into the fire of spring the winter cloak of repentance fling. For the bird of time flies but a short way, and lo, the bird is on the wing.
Wow.
I love Omar Khayyam.
Wow, that's right. That's right. That's wonderful,
that.
Yeah.
There is another great revelation in this book, mm-hmm. among many, that I was struck by, and that's the importance of the 1906-1911 Constitutional Revolution.
Right.
This must have been the point, Afshin, I would think, when some of the major or secular themes mm-hmm. of the country were raised. Is that correct? And perhaps even more to the point, does it still have resonance?
It certainly does have resonance. And the 1906 to 1911 Constitutional Revolution was the first time in Iran's history that the country agitated for representative government. It was the first time in the history that words like popular sovereignty were used. Mm-hmm. They were deeply influenced by Enlightenment thinkers, especially in some of their anti-clericalism, deeply influenced by Enlightenment thinkers. But the Constitutional Revolution, much like the 1979 Revolution, did have many different forces coming together at once for one target, against one target,
right.
which was the king.
Yeah.
So you had bazaar merchants who were agitating for one reason, particularly they wanted better economic conditions. Mm-hmm. You had the secular intellectuals who wanted a representative government. And then you had clergy who felt that this constitution, if they played their cards right, could mean the imposition of Islamic law on Iranian society. So again, you had different groups moving towards one goal, and it's important to note that the other goal of the constitutional movement was to reduce the power of foreign countries like Britain and Russia.
Britain and Russia. As a matter of fact, that will also be revelatory for Americans, that these were the two big boogeymen, if you will.
That's right.
of
That's
Iranian
right. Yeah,
history,
right.
certainly
yeah.
in the 19th century. There is a very moving point at which, among your many pilgrimages, you go to the cemetery where thousands of young men mm-hmm. are buried, the victims of the Iran-Iraq war, the casualties of that war. Mm-hmm. You go with a student whose name I think is Mohsen and a war veteran, Hassan.
That's right.
And these two young men have a kind of an edgy coexistence.
That's right.
But it's a beautiful anecdote because they come to an understanding, mm-hmm. Which I'll leave to the reader to discover. But you make the point through that experience that I thought was kind of telling, you called for, and I think the phrase was, maybe the sentence was, perhaps there's a need for a dialogue among Iranians.
Yes.
And that was kind of relevant.
Yes, yes, absolutely. This is something that I often say. President Khatami came out in 1998 with his idea of dialogue among civilizations. Mm-hmm. But the more I traveled in Iran, the more I realized that Iranians are not talking to each other the way they should. Mm-hmm. And the example of this war veteran and this young man was one example of that. Now, the war of 1980 to 88 was a devastating war.
Right.
About 350,000 Iranians died, an equal number of Iraqis died. But after the war was used by the government as a means to mobilize and as a means to stop any sort of reform movements, as a means to liberalize. The government would come out and say, oh, the people didn't fight this war for democracy. The blood of our martyrs was shed for Imam Khomeini. Mm-hmm. So young men like Mohsen, who was not a war veteran, came to resent the war and everything that stood for.
Right.
And young men like Hassan, who was a war veteran, he went to the war not because of these ideas of paradise and martyrdom. He went to the war out of purely nationalist reasons. Mm-hmm. And when Mohsen and Hassan came together, Mohsen began to realize that he went to war for these nationalist reasons. So they came to a certain understanding
right.
that they might not have had if there wasn't, you know, someone like me traveling and forcing these people to come together.
Exactly, and it's a gripping scene when that happens, and of course set against that background of all those tombs, it just, you know, it sticks with you. And of course for a Western reader, particularly an American, you think of our Vietnam veterans and the student protesters and their need to perhaps establish a dialogue as
That's
well
right.
in our country. You know, there's so many themes raised in this book. all of them of value, that, you know, one sort of struggles to come to a kind of a concluding question or a place to take this dialogue. I obviously very strongly recommend this book to people interested in Iran, people interested in America, and prospect for dialogue. But let me try this as a way of giving you a chance to sort of give us a sense of its ultimate meaning. Mm-hmm. As I read the book, Afshin, I came to think that the real pilgrimage may be a quest for self-identity. Mm-hmm. That involves the use of historical memory.
Right.
And of course, and also involves things we haven't had a chance to speak about, like coping with censorship and, sometimes deception is used as a way of coping with censorship, these sort of social aspects. Mm-hmm. But at the bottom is tradition and modernity.
That's right.
And maybe that's what the Iranians are wrestling with.
That's right. And this is a struggle that has been going on since the mid-19th century. And it's a struggle that's still taking place today in Iran. And I think from my travels to more than 20 cities and villages, it seems to me that Iranians have tried secular authoritarianism in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. They've tried religious authoritarianism in the late 20th century. I think they're moving towards the idea unanimously of pluralism and democracy.
And you think that it's going to be that 65% of Iran that's young that's going to make the final determination?
Absolutely. The demographics of Iran, nearly two-thirds of the population is under the age of 30. This means that about 50 million of Iran's 70 million people were either not born mm-hmm. or were unwitting children at the time of the revolution. And these children are going to be the wave of the future. And from what I gathered from my thousands of conversations with them is that they want social freedoms, they want political freedoms, and they want a better economy. And this is not something, this is something that all of us want, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
It is indeed. And because of that, maybe this is the very final question for, because you just stirred my curiosity mm-hmm. on it for even a brief comment. Mm-hmm. Because those requirements are so down to earth, so basic, so understandable, right. so like ours.
Right.
What do you think about, I'm sure you think there is a need for a dialogue. What are the prospects for making it happen? These two countries, our two societies, our American society, the one you and I share, and the Iranian mm-hmm. society should not be as estranged as they are.
That's right. That's right. And I think, on the government level, there's so much going on that it would probably take a whole show to discuss
right.
that. But I think on the civil society level, as you pointed out astutely, there should be dialogue going on. And people like the filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami should not be denied a visa, as he was, because this is a filmmaker, an artist, who is coming to America to show his films. And the most interesting thing is when I was in Iran, the American wrestling team was there.
Right.
And they were treated like rock stars. And I spoke with some of the wrestlers, yeah. and they're accustomed to wrestling in small arenas. Mm-hmm. Wrestling is not a big sport in America, but it's a huge sport in Iran. And they said that they would like to come back to Iran over and over again because of how well they were treated.
Well, I join you in the hope we can have many more of those exchanges.
That's right.
And I also want to join you in support of Persian pilgrimages.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
People will enjoy reading as much as I did.
And I thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. And it was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it was extremely well deserved. So
thank you very much.
Afshin Mohlavi.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Afshin Mohlavi. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds.